After wishing everyone a good morning, I don't think I need this, so I'm going to move it over to here a little bit. I want to speak to you about, first of all, the value of life. You know, we've been discussing the case of a woman perhaps putting her life into danger in order to save the life of the fetus, and touching on this entire concept of the value of life. And the Torah, the halacha, has a very unique approach when you compare it to Western culture regarding the value of life. We have a principle called Lo Tamod Al Dam Riach. Thou shalt not stand idly by when the blood of your fellow Jew is being spilled. Even though it means being passive. We're not talking about a situation in which a person is actively involved in taking someone else's life. We're just talking about a person who's watching a situation, someone's drowning, Rahmanul Itzlan, you could jump in and possibly save him. Someone is being dragged away by dangerous animals or dangerous marauders, and you could possibly save him. If you fail to do so, then you violate a basic ethical principle in Judaism, which is called Lo Tamad Al Dam Riecha. You're not allowed to stand idly. You know, in Western society, we have a principle called mind your own business. You know, a person can come onto a train, and he's mugging somebody, and all of a sudden, everybody is reading their newspaper, you know, really close up, and there's been, you know, documented cases like that, both in America and in England and other countries. You know, the philosophy of I didn't do anything wrong, I was just minding my own business. I was just standing on the sidelines. But that's not the approach of Judaism. In fact, not only is there a violation of a law of a do not stand idly by, but there's even a violation of a mitzvah. The mitzvah tells us that we are commanded to save someone. And it's derived from a parasha that we read last week, which is called Hashavas Aveda. You have to return someone's lost object. And the Gemara says you have to return someone's lost object. How much more so do you have to return their life to them? And the Torah, when it says return, it says Vashivoso lo. It doesn't say Vashivosa lo, return it to him, but return him to him. And that is the source for the mitzvah of Hatzolah. So that's a great mitzvah. And the Mishnah codifies it in Sanhedrin, says if a person saves one life, it's as if he saved an entire universe. Lama nivra adam yechidi, why was man created alone? Because it teaches you that one person is worth a world. Now, on the opposite end of the spectrum, we have a prohibition which is called Lo Tirtzach, thou shalt not kill. And the Gemara establishes in Masechta Sanhedrin that we can never violate this prohibition of killing, even if it means giving up one's life. So the Gemara establishes that if a person would threaten to kill you unless you kill someone else, you're not allowed to kill that someone else. You have to let yourself die, because there are three averos, which are cardinal sins, and the rule that applies to them is you have to give up your life rather than violating them. So we suspend the normal rule of achaybo hem apikuach nefesh. We have to do everything to save someone's life, but not to violate any of these three cardinal sins. And if you take a look at the first source on your page, you'll see that Nimnu v'gamru b'aliyas beis nitzis of Belud, there was a place where the Sanhedrin gathered together, perhaps clandestinely, during times of persecution in Lud, and they determined that although kol averus shebatorah, with regard to all averus in the Torah, if you violate them, then the Torah says, for the sake of saving life, you should live by them, and you're allowed to override those averos, but not in three cases of avodah zarah and gilarayas and shvichas damim. These are the three exceptions to the rule. The Gemara goes on to ask, how do we know? How do we know that in the case of shvichas damim, you're not allowed to violate that even at the pain of death? And the answer is, because it says that my domach the chavrech sumach tvei duma domach. How do you know domach the dach sumach tvei? Do you remember this? The Gemara says, who says that your blood is redder than his? Maybe his blood is redder than yours. Rashi says we don't know whose nefesh is more cherished, is more beloved in the eyes of the Almighty. You can't make that judgment call. Therefore, you have to be passive. You're not allowed to take someone's life, even to save your own life. So on the one end, there's a great mitzvah of saving lives, of lotam el dam riachah. That's called the mitzvah of hatzolas nefashos. On the other hand, there's a prohibition of lo tirtzach, which means that we're not allowed to kill someone. And the question that I want to address today is what happens in a case where we have a conflict, a head-on collision. We have a mitzvah to save, but we have a lo taseh of lo tirtzach, not to kill. Obviously, with all great and due respect to the mitzvah of saving someone, but not at the expense of allowing murder. We don't allow murder even for the sake of saving someone. So what is my question for today? When is it relevant to ask this question about the conflict? What happens if we can sacrifice one individual and save the multitude? We could save the many. Is there a possibility that we look at V'chai Bohem, at the significance, or shall I say the infinite value of human life, and now we multiply it? We can save the many even if we sacrifice the individual. On an intuitive level, I would say it makes sense, because we want to do damage control. We want to cut our losses. And since we have a V'chai Bohem multiple times, that on a scale will outweigh the individual. But on the other hand, the Torah says, lo tirtzach. The Torah says you can't sacrifice the individual, because that would be a violation of lo tirtzach. And we have to give up our lives. There's no heter, there's no permissibility for the sake of even the greater good to violate this prohibition of murder. Intuitively, we might come to the conclusion, my moral and ethical intuition would tell me, that let's make a calculation here and let's come to the conclusion that in terms of the ultimate damage, it makes sense to minimize that damage. But the halacha works with certain principles. And one of those principles is yehari gal yavra, that you can't kill anybody, even if it means you have to give up your life. So even if many people would have to give up their lives, as long as we're not murdering someone, that's what the halacha would have to be. We can't make these intuitive calculations and come to some moral, ethical principle. Yes, let's sacrifice the one for the many. So this is the question of hatsola versus ritzicha. Hatsola meaning saving life. And now it collides and there's a collision with the avera of not killing someone. So you have saving someone's life. And in this case, you want to save many people's lives. And on the other hand, we can't kill someone for any reason whatsoever. There's no permissibility, there's no flexibility at all in halacha. So what would we say in this case? And this case is actually addressed in a Tosefta. And the Tosefta is in Masechta Trumos. We'll see it inside in a minute. I just want to tell it to you outside so you get the overall picture of what's going on here in this Tosefta. The case is that the enemies surround the city and they're pressing. We want one Jew from this city. We'll put him to death. If you don't offer one Jew, we will destroy the entire city. Are we permitted, ask the Tosefta, to offer one Jew, sacrifice the one for the sake of the many? So the Tosefta now we'll see inside, I hope it's on your page 2. Do you see in the second source on page 2, it says Tosefta? Do you have such a thing? Okay, good. Seyash al bnei Adam, there's a group of people, and they live together in a city. Sha'amru lehem nachrim, the goyim said to them, Tnu lanu echad mikem v'nargehu, give us one of you, or we'll kill the entire city. Hargim es kula. So what's the law in this case? Yehargu kulam v'al yimsru lehem nefesh achas v'Yisrael. They have to all die. They can't give up one Jew for death. Wow, that's a pretty heavy principle. And we'll soon see this is codified by the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, and all the codes. Volunteer would be something else. That would be chassidut, that would be a piety, an extra piety on his behalf.
He would be allowed to volunteer.
Yes, for sure. That would be a midas chassidus, if we could only find someone who's willing to sacrifice himself. But in this case, we are called upon to choose one Jew, give him over to be killed, and the Tosefta prohibits it. Now keep in mind that a Tosefta is very, very powerful in terms of development of halacha. Why? Because the Tosefta goes back to the time of the Mishnah. We're talking about Tanoim. And even though the Tosefta was omitted from the Mishnah, but in a case where we have no other source other than a Tosefta, that's going to be the reliable source for halacha. And the Rambam codifies this, and it's brought down in Shulchan Aruch. We're not allowed to give up a Jew. If the story would end here, everything is crystal clear. But as you know, somebody had to give me, you know, a full hour's worth of lecture time, so the story has to get more complicated. So if you look at the next line of the Tosefta, it says the following, Aval im yichdu lahem, which literally translates as they specified one Jew. It wasn't that they gave us the choice. You know, we have to decide who we should give up. They want Ploni, this person, Kigon, and now the Tosefta says that there was an actual case in Jewish history, codified in the Tanakh, of this sort, Sheyichdu l'Sheva ben Bichri. We'll get back to Sheva ben Bichri in just a moment. We okay, David? I should bring it closer? I hear an echo. Does this bother anybody? If it doesn't bother anybody, we're good. It bothers me, but I'll survive it. David, you telling me I need this or not? Aval im yichdu lahem kigon sheyichdu l'sheva ben bichri yargu yitnu lahem, they can give him up the al yehargu, and they will save their lives. So here's a case, a breakthrough case, where you're allowed to sacrifice the individual for the sake of the multitude, but only on the condition that yichduhu, that they singled out one individual. Who is this Sheva ben Bichri? You'll see in Shmuel Beis, which is right below the Tosefta. Sheva ben Bichri was a Moreid b'Malchus, which means he rebelled against the kingship of David. And they were after him. They sent the police to get him. Yoav ben Tsruya was the arm, the military arm of David HaMelech, and he went to find Sheva ben Bichri. Word got out that Sheva ben Bichri was hiding in a certain city. He had taken refuge in a city. Yoav ben Tsruya warns the city, you must give up Sheva ben Bichri or we'll raise the city to the ground. And the Tanakh records, Vatomer HaIsha, a woman came forward, apparently a very wise woman, and she said, we're going to take care of him. And they threw his head over the wall, and they declared and sent a message to Yoav, Hine Rosho Mushlach Elecha, Biarachoma. And as a result of the chachma of this woman, the city was saved. Who was this woman? Chazal say she was none other than Sarah Bas Osher. She was alive hundreds of years later than Asher. Asher was one of the children of Yaakov Avinu. So she was the granddaughter of Yaakov Avinu. And she's alive at the time of David. That's hundreds of years later. And she was a very wise woman. So the Tosefta quotes this case of Sheva ben Bichri, where those who were about to kill every member of the city were out for one individual. That's called Yichduhu. They isolated one person. And once they single out one person, the halacha is you're allowed to give up that one person in order to save the multitude. Now the question is,
he was a criminal.
Excellent.
Not to kill?
No, I'll tell you why. Because Sheva ben Bichri, Sheva ben Bichri was called a Moreid b'Malchus, and he has to be put to death. The people were warned that if you don't give it, if you can find him, and you'll have to cough him up, otherwise we're going to raise the whole city. That was the way they threatened the city, who wanted to give refuge to Sheva ben Bichri, and at the end of the day, they actually killed Sheva ben Bichri, and the city was spared. So now the question is, what does Yushalmi mean when it says Yichdu, that since the enemy has pointed and singled out one individual, you're allowed to give him up for death? So the Yushalmi, very often a Tosefta appears also in the Talmud Yushalmi, and the Yushalmi in Trumos records a machlokas, which is the bottom source on your page 2, a tremendous fundamental debate between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. Now keep in mind that Reish Lakish was a student of Rabbi Yochanan. And the debate is the following. Reish Lakish insists that what the Tosefta, the Braisa, has in mind, that Yichdu, you're allowed to give him up, is only a case of someone who's Chai of Misa, someone who has to be put to death, like Sheva ben Bichri. You don't have any rights to go beyond the case of Sheva ben Bichri because the Tosefta says the paradigm for Yichdu. And Rabbi Yochanan says, no, anytime Yichdu, if the enemy singles out one person, you're allowed to give up this person. So let's review. According to Reish Lakish, when the Yerushalmi says Yichdu, they singled him out, you're allowed to give him up, that's only a case that's equivalent to Sheva ben Bichri, where he was anyway deserving of death. But if he's not a criminal and he's an innocent person, Reish Lakish says you can't give him up. Let the whole city die. Rabbi Yochanan says no. The Tosefta only intended to give us an example of Sheva ben Bichri. We're not limited. We don't have to compare it only specifically to that case where Sheva ben Bichri was a Moreid b'Malchus and therefore he was condemned to death. But any person, even if he's innocent, if the enemy singles him out, give him up to save the multitudes. The question is, how does the halacha, how do we paskin in the final normative halacha? If we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan, who's the Rebbe, then this has tremendous repercussions. We can forfeit the individual for the sake of saving the multitudes. If we paskin like Reish Lakish, then this halach of Yichdu is really just theoretical. It almost has no practical implications because it only applies to that one specific case, which is similar to Sheva ben Bichri, of someone who deserved to die anyway. So if you were to guess, let's say I would put you in the Rambam's feet, in his shoes, who would you think we paskin like? Rabbi Yochanan, because we always paskin like Rabbi Yochanan against Reish Lakish. He's the Rebbe, and the Rambam paskins like Reish Lakish. The Rambam says, "Im yichduhu kesheva ben bichri shuchai of misa, then and only then are you allowed to give him up." And even then, the Rambam says, you should be very careful before you give him up until you're absolutely convinced that he is deserving of death. And the Kesef Mishnah and all the other super commentaries on the Rambam are perplexed. We need a guide to the perplexed. Why does the Rambam accept the sheet of Reish Lakish against that of Rabbi Yochanan? Now, the Shulchan Aruch accepts the Rambam, you know, hook, line, and sinker, basically copies the Rambam verbatim, and Rabbi Yosef Kairo in the Shulchan Aruch says that you can only give up the individual for the sake of the multitudes if that individual deserves to die. The Rambam, as you know, who adds his comments to the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Moshe Isserles, he writes, V'yesh omrim, but others say, afilu im eino chayav misa, meaning there are those who accept the shita of Rabbi Yochanan. But you get the impression from the Ramah that that's only a yesh omrim. You know, he quotes it as almost like a footnote, but primarily the halach is with Reish Lakish because the Rambam accepted Reish Lakish and the Shulchan Aruch accepted Reish Lakish, and we can only give up the individual to save the multitudes if that individual is Chayav Misa. The Vilna Gaon, in his Bir Agra, you know, the Gaon, the Vilna Gaon has his comments on the Shulchan Aruch. He says that he doesn't understand the Rambam. Why did the Rambam accept the sheet of Reish Lakish? And therefore we should paskin like Rabbi Yochanan. So it comes out that this fundamental issue about giving up someone to die in order to save the multitudes, in halacha, becomes a real serious issue, because on the one end, the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch and even the Ramah seem to indicate that the halacha is like Reish Lakish. We can't give up. We can't forfeit the individual, except for that one rare case of someone who's chayav misa anyway. But yet the Gaon says that he doesn't have a clue as to why they should accept Reish Lakish when the general rule of Psak is that we accept Rabbi Yochanan against Reish Lakish. And therefore the Gaon wants to embrace the sheet of Rabbi Yochanan, which would turn us around upside down a full 180 degrees, because it means that we can sacrifice the individual for the sake of saving the klal. So this issue came up at the time of the first war in Lebanon. So going back to the early 1980s. But before that, a theoretical case, and we'll see if it's similar, was brought up by none other than the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was the final decider of halacha, decisor in Eretz Yisrael, let's say about a half a century ago. I mean, he was considered like the giant of giants. And he was asked the following question. A hand grenade is coming towards a bunker, and if nothing happens, all the soldiers, all the chayalim in that bunker will perish. Is a person allowed to deflect the hand grenade, push it towards one side, in such a way that those who are sitting on that side, those who are located, will die, will perish, but in doing so, those who are on this side will survive? And when you think about it, this is really our question, because the moment that you deflect the hand grenade in one direction, you are basically causing the death of those chayalim who are on that side of the bunker. But on the other hand, you're doing it for the greater good, because there are less soldiers on this side, which they'll die, than there are the majority of the soldiers will survive. And again, you know, you're dealing with an issue of life and death. Now, just for your information, if you're curious about this, a very similar case is quoted multiple times in the annals of ethics. I'm talking about secular ethics. This is the famous locomotive case. Are you familiar with it? Where the locomotive goes off track and the conductor has a possibility of moving the locomotive in a way that he will kill a person, but everyone else will survive. So I just want you to know that although the Chazon Ish was likely unaware of the fact that in all the books of ethics, this case is taken up, and I'll tell you the truth, he couldn't care less probably. He's interested in knowing the halacha, and at first he wants to suggest that this should depend upon the debate between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, meaning, according to Reish Lakish, those soldiers on that side where he'll deflect the hand grenade, they'll perish, they are totally innocent. They're not like Sheva ben Bichri. And according to Reish Lakish, you cannot sacrifice even the one or two people for the sake of the multitudes. So there's no game here of individual versus majority. But according to Rabbi Yochanan, who says that if you could designate these individuals, then you could save the multitudes, even though they're not guilty in any way, then Rabbi Yochanan would allow you to do this thing and sacrifice the lower numbers for the higher numbers. But the question is, do we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan? And the Chazon Ish admits that in all the codes, we paskin like Reish Lakish. He mentions that the Gaon of Vilna is absolutely confused as to why we paskin like the Talmud Reish Lakish against the Rebbe, against Rabbi Yochanan, and therefore the Gaon seems to be inclined to accept Rabbi Yochanan, but that's not good enough for the Chazon Ish. So the Chazon Ish comes up with the following logic. And he says the following, that when the hand grenade is coming towards you, and you put up your hand to deflect it, that's not called ritzicha. That's not called murder. That's called hatzola. That's called saving yourself. What a thin, subtle distinction. You can cut this with a razor. It's so thin. The Chazon Ish says that we have to classify and define, based on our halachic logic, what is the nature of this action of deflecting the hand grenade. Do we see it as an act of murder, or do we see it as an act of hatzola? In other words, when this person deflects the hand grenade, he's saving himself and all of his buddies who are on that side of the bunker. Says the Chazon Ish, that's an act of hatzol. Indirectly, as a result, somebody is going to die. I shudder when I think about this, because how do you know whether you define this as an act of hatzol or an act of murder? For example, if I would take a video camera and just get that one frame of a person who's pushing a hand grenade onto the soldiers, that's an act of murder. I would certainly define it as act of murder. But the Chazon Ish is willing to see that act in a broader context. Take it out of that little frame and see what he's actually doing and what motivates him. In this case, the hand grenade is coming towards him. He's not involved in murder. He's involved in pushing it to the other side. And one of the commentaries, which we'll get to a little later, says that imagine if a bullet or an arrow is coming towards you, you know that there's someone standing behind you. Are you allowed to bow or bend in such a way that the arrow is not going to kill you, it's going to kill someone else? And the answer is you're allowed to do that. But that clearly is an act of hatzola. You're saving yourself. As a result, someone else will die, but here you're actively doing something. This is not like the case where you duck, And as a result, somebody dies. You know what I mean? Ducking is not an act in any way of propelling something towards someone else's body and he's going to be the victim of death. Correct. That's what you discussed before. Again, I'm going to go back and I'm going to repeat what I told you before. We're not talking now about Midas Chassidus. Midas Chassidus would mean we're going to give you the greatest accolades and you're on the highest level if you're willing to sacrifice yourself for the sake of the many. That's undeniable. But what we're asking is, what's legally prohibited or legally permitted? What's the law of Issa Veheter? How far can I go if I want to save myself and my buddies? And we represent the majority of the group in the bunker. Can I go as far as to kill someone? Or maybe even more than one person, but the minority of people? Says the Chazon Ish, yes, but only on one condition. If I'm able to define your action as an act of hatzola, that is considered permissible. So we're not going as far as Rabbi Yochanan. Please keep in mind, Rabbi Yochanan, but we don't paskin like Rabbi Yochanan, is going to allow you to give up someone for death. That's an active killing of someone to save the city. That far we won't go. But what we will say is that if we can construct an action that's not giving up a person to die, I'm not picking up someone and throwing him into the lion's den or to the sharks to eat up, but what I'm doing is I'm just protecting myself and my buddies, that's an act of hatzola. And an act of hatzola for the sake of the rabim, of the multitude, is permissible, even though as an indirect result of that hatzola, other people will die. And this leads me, if you give me just one more minute, to the question that I want to address to you, and that is the case in the Lebanese War. What happened was the Israeli soldiers entered into Lebanon, and they designated a very tall building that had five floors in the city of Tyre as the headquarters of Tzal at that time. And because of a car bomb, right? A car bomb exploded, and the entire building fell apart with all the soldiers inside. Now, in digging out the debris in order to save the soldiers, here was the moral and halachic conflict or issue. There were fewer soldiers on the higher floors. Most of the soldiers were on the lower floors. Would it be permissible to take a tractor and cut into the higher floors. You can imagine everything was on seconds. You know, there was no time to deliberate this. It was a matter of urgency. Now, in this case, there was no doubt that soldiers would be killed. But if they could get down to the bottom by clearing off the debris of the first four floors and get down to the bottom floor, they could save many, many soldiers. Again, it comes down to the issue of sacrificing the few for the many. Would this be okay? Comes along Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein Shlita, so we're talking about a contemporary, and in his writings, they asked him, what would he say? Again, it was not relevant at that moment, but it could be relevant in the future because this is an issue of Ritzicha, of killing soldiers for the sake of Hatzolah, for saving the multitudes. And he applied the Chazon Ish. And he said that when the tractors come and they cut into the higher floors, that's not an act of Ritzicha. That's an act of Hatzolah. Why? Because they're doing so not for the sake of killing, heaven forbid, but rather for the sake of saving. And if we could define this as an act of Hatzolah, rather than an act of Ritzicha, then we could apply the rule of the Chazon Ish that we can save the many, even if it means sacrificing the few. Somebody is standing right behind you. You know he's going to die.
Yeah, but that's not the same as saving people.
So the post can say you're allowed to do that to save yourself. Because you're not doing it, but you're not causing his death. Why? Because although he's going to die, but there's not an act of murder here. What's considered an act of murder? Is ducking to avoid an arrow, is that called murder?
Right,
that's also true. Maybe, but let's say there would be no time. You know, we were talking about split seconds, but you're right. In theory, maybe he'll save himself. But let's say I grant you the following scenario. There's no way he could survive. He's going to die. That's not a case of Ritzicha. Again, our discussion today is a collision between what's considered an act of murder. There's no way that you can say ducking from an arrow that's about to kill you is an act of murder. You could say that pushing a hand grenade onto those soldiers on that side, that could be possibly construed, the Chazon Ish refuses, but I would suggest maybe that's an act of murder. You could talk about tractors cutting into the top layers of the building, the floors of the building, and that is an act of murder. You are directly killing them. But for the ultimate good of Hatzolah, and if it's for Hatzolah, can I redefine the action in its broader context and see it not as an act of murder, but as an act of Hatzolah? And that's where the Chazon Ish made his, what I call, historic responsa. That's the name of our series, right? And his tshuva was that in this case, you're allowed to push the hand grenade. Why? Because that's not an act of murder. And we say in Yiddish, shtel zechfar, right? Imagine what the Chazon Ish is saying. What do you mean it's not an act of murder? For sure it's an act of murder. You push a hand grenade onto someone, and he dies? Is that not an act of murder? No, it's not. Why? Because the Chazon Ish says, you're only defending yourself. But in the case where you duck, that's not an act of murder. There we certainly agree with the Chazon Ish. Nobody questions this. But those who want to claim that the justification for the Chazon Ish is I'm allowed to duck when somebody else will die, that's a very weak assumption. So now this question came up in the Shoah during the Holocaust. And it came up in a number of different ways. One way was there was a baby that was crying and the Nazis would find the Jewish people. And the question was, where they would, in order to stop this noise, they would have to kill the baby, smother the baby to death. Another case was a person whose son was taken by the capos. It was on Rosh Hashanah, I think it was 1941. And the capo had a certain quota. He had to fill 1,400 children. To be killed on Rosh Hashanah. You know, the Nazis loved Jewish holidays, you know. And he had smuggled something out of his ghetto before he was transported, and he could actually bribe the capo. But what it meant was that they would take another Jew. They would take another child to replace that one because the capo had to fill his quota. All these cases are cases where I don't know if this is Hatzolah or if this is Ritzicha, what does it mean? You remember that we spoke about the case in the Tosefta where you give up one Jew and he will be killed. Here, in the case of the child, well, I'm not giving a Jew. I know full well that the Kepo will choose a Jew to replace my child, but it's not something that I'm doing. It's one step more removed than the case of giving someone else to be killed. The more complicated case will be the case of smothering a baby to death. I mean, that's clearly an act of ritzicha. Now, one of the sources on your page, which is an exception to all the rules that we've been discussing, is a Gemara in Sanhedrin called Rodef. And the Gemara says that if a baby is about to be born and the birth process endangers the life of the mother, you're allowed to put the baby to death. Let's assume, again, this is a major assumption on my part, don't accept it, I'm not... But theoretically, and there is such a school of thought, the fetus is considered a living being. Do you remember that I discussed the concept of a fetus being considered a nefesh for those who were with me last week? And abortion is murder. If that be the case, then how do we allow killing the fetus before it's born in order to save the mother? I mean, that's nefesh, that you're taking the nefesh of the fetus and you're actively doing it. So the Gemara answers, that's called a rodef. A rodef means when someone is endangering the life of someone else. And in the Holocaust, when this question came up, again, I'm not telling you that they had time, you know, to go ask Rabbi Meisels, who was the posek, you know, he was the posek. I mean, it's almost like a bitter joke, because if you saw him when he in Auschwitz, you know, the last thing you would say was that he was a posek. But in theory, he said that the baby is considered a rodef, meaning this baby that's about to cry and through the noise the Nazis will find the Jews, that's called a rodef. He is endangering the life of the people. And therefore I submit to you that this case in the Holocaust is not really our discussion. Our discussion is irrelevant and independent of rodef, meaning none of the cases that we're dealing with, like the soldiers who are trapped in the debris on the higher floors, or the case of the soldiers who will be killed by virtue of this hand grenade, in none of those cases, and there are many other such cases, are we dealing with a rodef. No one is endangering the life of others. The situation is such that we could save the multitudes by sacrificing the minority, the smaller numbers. But it's not that those people, those smaller numbers, are in any way endangering the life of someone else. Excellent. Then that's an excellent question. You know, a first responder at 9/11, would I have to go in to save other people's lives, knowing full well that I'm exposing myself to danger? And if you remember, we mentioned last week the breakthrough tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef in regard to the Uganda situation, and we said that Rav Avadya Yosef, if not for something which we'll call X right now, he was absolutely opposed to exposing the soldiers to danger in order to save the hostages. At the end, the X was that it's terrorism, and in terrorism we have a mitzvah molchama. But until he gets to that for 39 pages, he says, how can you think of exposing the soldiers to danger? Now, there's a Dayan today whose name is Dichovsky. This Rabbi Dichovsky, his first name is Shlomo, he saw someone who wrote that you can justify what Sahal did when they destroyed the debris in the higher floors of this headquarters of Tzahal for the sake of saving the soldiers on the bottom by quoting the Chazon Ish. That just like the Chazon Ish said, you're allowed to deflect the hand grenade, and that's called an act of Hatzol and not an act of Ritzicha, we could apply the same logic that destroying the higher floors, killing those soldiers, for the sake of... That's called a Hatzola Nata Ritzicha. So Rav Dachovsky says that's absolutely wrong. That's incorrect. Why? Because in the case of the Chazon Ish, everything is happening simultaneously. Whereas in the case in Lebanon, it's happening in sequence. Let me explain. Just I want to know how we're doing on the clock. I don't want to... We have another few minutes. So here's what Rav Dichovsky claims. That the Chazon Ish was limited to a case where there's one action which achieves two goals simultaneously. That action of deflecting the hand grenade is on the one hand an act of Hatzolah, on the other hand it's an act of Ritzicha. However, if let's say there was a Bazach Arzeh, which means in sequence, it wasn't simultaneous, you'd have to kill the soldiers on the upper floor in order to expose the debris on the bottom floor and save the soldiers on the bottom floor, the multitude, that the Chazon Ish himself would have definitely prohibited. Because you cannot consider an act of Hatzolah, you cannot consider a killing, an act of Hatzolah, unless at the moment, at that very action that is defined as Ritzicha, I can redefine it as Hatzolah. It doesn't mean that the greater good and my ultimate goal allows me to redefine the act of Ritzicha. That's not what the Chazon Ish had in mind, says Rabbi Chomsky. What the Chazon Ish had in mind is that if I have an act and I have to now subsume that act and define its personality under one of two possible categories, as an act of Hatzolah or as an act of Ritzicha, I have a right to say that I'm engaging in this action in order to save people. That act is now defined as Hatzolah. But to do an act of Ritzicha and kill someone for the sake of ultimately saving the multitude, even the Chazon Ish would prohibit it. And therefore, says Rydzajkowski, there's no license to save the soldiers on the bottom floor and murder the soldiers, in effect, on the top floor. Now, I'm not here to decide, but I just wanted to present to you an approach which limits the Chazon Ish. Because I'll tell you what I'm afraid of. This is Berzon talking, emotionally. I'm just afraid of taking this Chazon Ish as a carte blanche. As if the Chazon Ish will say, anytime you're murdering someone for the sake of saving someone, and you're murdering the individual for the sake of saving the klal, then the Chazon Ish would say it's perfectly permissible. We don't paskin like Rabbi Yochanan. So it would not be permissible. The Chazon Ish has to be limited. If you don't restrict the Chazon Ish, then it's all hefker. It's anarchy. You can come to crazy conclusions, which is against antithetical to the halacha. The halacha is you give up your life rather than kill someone. And it doesn't matter whether you're giving up your life rather than killing someone for the sake of saving your own skin or you're saving the entire city. It matters not. Ritzicha is one of the big three. It's a cardinal sin. And here's where I want to discuss with you the following case in the Gemara Bava Kamma. This is the Panim Meiros, one of the great responsa literature. And the Gemara says the following, that let's say there's a flood that's about to inundate your field. If you put up a barrier, a dam, in order to protect your field, you will redirect the waters and they will inundate someone else's field. Are you permitted to do whatever you have to do to save your field from inundation, from flooding, knowing full well that your next door neighbor's field is going to be flooded? And the Gemara says it depends. At what point, says the Gemara, are you setting up this barrier? Has the water already begun to flush in your direction? There's already an action of the water, so to speak, in which it's pushing towards your field. If so, you're not allowed to touch it. Because if you redirect the water, you are a mazik, you are damaging your friends, your neighbor's property. But if the water hasn't started coming yet, you know it's on the way, but it's not in any close proximity, and you want to nip it in the bud and set up a barrier around your field, that you're allowed to do. Yeah, again, we're assuming now there's no time to tell your neighbor. You've done whatever you could to tell your neighbor. Your neighbor is from Florida. I don't know why he would go to Florida on vacation, but he's in Florida. He's not to be. Or he went to Orlando. You know, nowadays we go to Las Vegas. You know all the places. He's not available. We would love to notify the neighbor. We'll send him every single email and every single Facebook you can imagine. But it won't help. So can I make this last minute decision and set up the barrier? And the Gemara says, no, I have to set up the barrier in advance. So the Panim Meiros says that what this Gemara is teaching us is that you cannot do an action on the mazik itself. Let me explain. Is this water, as it's rushing and streaming towards flooding your field, is that called a mazik? A mazik means a damager. You see, all of Masecht Bava Kama is all based on the laws of torts, you know, of nazikin, on whether or not you call something a mazik. How do you define it? How do you classify it? So the Mishnah starts the Masecht Bava Kama with four categories of mazikin: a shor, bar, a maver, and hever, right? Those are the categories of mazikin. How do you view this water? If the water is already a mazik, then what you're doing is you're redirecting that mazik towards someone else. That you can't do. You cannot save yourself at the expense of sending the mazik in the direction of your neighbor. What you can do is you can set up your protective barriers before the water is called a mazik. When it's at a distance, and now I can predict that at some point in the near future it's going to start moving in my direction, then I can do whatever I have to do to protect my field. So I have to tell you the truth. The Panim Eros does not do so. The Panim Eros is only discussing the laws of Nezikin. Rav Shlomo Daichovsky is the one who quotes this Panim Eros in order to analyze the case of the soldiers in the headquarters of Tzal in Lebanon, in Tyre. And according to Rav Daichovsky, what the Chazon Ish was saying is that if you're attacking the mazik itself, then and only then I can start defining it as either an act of ritzicha or an act of hatzolah. So therefore, if we focus all our attention on that hand grenade, which is in the direction, it's flying towards this bunker, then I already define and classify that hand grenade as the mazik. In this case, it's not only the mazik, it's the memis. It's really the dangerous, murderous weapon over here. But in the case of Lebanon, what are you telling me? You're telling me that the soldiers on the top floor are considered a mazik? They're considered a rotzeach? For sure not. They're buried under debris. And in such a case, the Chazon Ish would not allow it. Now, as I close, because I know we're running out of time, I just want to mention to you a list of cases that came up in the literature over the course of time. One case is the following. We are in desperate need of a life-supporting, a machine, if you know what I'm saying. You're right, but what's the word in general? You know, it could be a respirator, it could be a dialysis machine, whatever the generic term is, it's a life support machine. And there's only one in the hospital. And there are many cholim, one of which is on that machine. Are we allowed to disconnect the machine and lose one patient for the sake of the rest of the members of this ward that are going to die if you don't give them that life-saving support? Here's another question that came up. There are terrorists that are about to blow up and chas shalom create a massive death. We can kill the terrorists, but at the same time, we're going to have to kill a number of innocent Jews who are located in close proximity. Are we allowed to kill the terrorists and together with the terrorists, kill innocent Jewish people for the sake of protecting the multitudes who are going to die? Another case that came up. A rofe, a physician is called upon to decide whether to save the multitudes because he's the only one on the ward, or to save one individual chola. He's already picked up that chola. Can he drop that chola and let that chola perish for the sake of the multitudes? We have another case here of chayalim, and the chayalim realize that if they shoot towards that one enemy, some chayalim will die. For example, Rav Zilberstein that I mentioned earlier, and with this we'll close, he paskins that a chovesh, a medic, is obligated listaken to put his life into danger for saving the life of a soldier who is hit and he's lying out in the field. when he, the medic, goes out to save him, he's exposing himself to danger. But he has to do so. That's his job. And that's his responsibility. And based on this tshuva Rav Zilberstein, he wants to say that lifesavers and first responders and so forth, you know, you're talking about swimmers, and they all fit into this category where they're obligated to place their life into danger in order to save many, many other lives. So we'll call it now because time is if anyone has any questions, please see me. And next week, we're going to try to put this all together, talk about fetal intervention because we have one more piece in fetal intervention, and talk about the question of putting one's life into danger in order to save other lives. Okay then? Now somebody had mentioned September 11th, so we'll talk a little about September 11th because there was a plane that they wanted to down the plane, if you remember, in order to save the multitude. So we'll talk about that.